Art Blog Radio. Recently, Roberta and I sat down with Scott Kipp about his latest show at Arcadia University. He's brought to Arcadia by the directors Matthew Borgen and Richard Torsia. First, we'll start with our interview with Scott to hear his thought process behind his show.
Describe the installation in your words. It's been described by many people in many ways. This morning in an email that you sent out to people, you said this holy mess.
It's a holy mess. I mean, it's true. The project was a long time coming. And of course, I ran through a million different versions of it in my head. And then the one that ends up getting brought to reality is never exactly one of those versions. But I mean, what I tried to do was basically just what I say is I tried to make a sculpture out of everything that's ever happened to me in my life, which is not plausible, but it's fun to try. But how do I describe the installation to people? I mean, it's, I don't know, that's tough. I still don't have a good way to do that.
Well, I think between holy mess and sculpture out of everything that ever happened kind of covers it.
Yeah. Comprehensive.
Yeah, if not, it may not be helpful, but it may be comprehensive. There's a lot to it. I mean, mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of make, I mean, of course, it's a self-portrait in a way. I don't know. I feel like it's composed out of a lot of different experiences. And I don't mean experiences that I've had. I mean, I don't know if you've had the experience of, and this is a typical art school kind of a thing, but it's trash day. You're walking home and you see a really fascinating pile of trash on the side of the road. That's not trash bags usually, but it might be whatever, cans or a dumpster. And you're like, oh, what is this? And you start looking through it because there's some interesting items. And then you realize that it's the same person's name on all of the documents and papers and whatever's in there. And then you realize, wait, this is someone's stuff. Like, this is a clean out. And then you kind of go through it and then you create this portrait of the person in your head and their life. I don't know if you have this experience, but this is an art school. This is an art kid thing that would happen, you know? And so I wanted to make an experience sort of like that.
So wait, did you have an art school experience that was just what you said, where you happened
many times? Sure. Downtown. I mean, I went to University of the Arts, and so I spent a lot of time downtown in the mid to late 90s. And I guess there were a lot of renovations happening. And so you'd see a dumpster and you're always looking for interesting stuff as an artist. Also, I mean, I kind of grew up on a skateboard, like skating around downtown and going to like Love Park and City Hall every day. And
do you still skate?
Much as I can. It depends upon the weather. I mean, it's a little more. But I mean, basically, any day that's warmer than 60 or 65 and it doesn't rain, I'll try to go skate. So, I mean, I'm kind of a compulsive practicer, one of many things. But
oh, no, it's all on the track. Come on. It's all about everything. Everything is relevant, yeah. Right? Let's get back to your inventory, which I find fascinating. You've got an itemization of objects, including skateboard decks, as we just mentioned, every skateboard deck that I have worn out from 1991 to the present.
Yeah.
And that is a formidable pile of decks, and you've got them up high. That's near the ceiling. Talk about the placement of where things went. This is an installation for our students. We have two students who are sitting and listening here we're working with this semester, Chi and Anjali. And
hi, students.
Hi, students. And they're very excited to be here, and we're excited to have them. But they haven't seen this. So explain that this is in a 33-foot tall space, right? And you mm-hmm. use every inch of the space from the top pretty much down to the floor. So talk, and there's scaffolding. So some things are up high on scaffolding. Some things are down low on the floor. Talk about the relation to the ceiling versus the floor. Was there a metaphorical relation? Are skateboards closer to heaven than...
No, there. I mean, so if you wanted me to describe the installation in the most literal sense, I mean, I took just an 1,100 square foot rectangular gallery space and built out the entire thing. I basically wanted to make something akin to the experience of sort of exploring an abandoned building or an abandoned space. Mm. but in a way that's safe for viewers. And it's sort of like a giant still life, like a giant cluttered still life space at the center of the gallery. And there is a built environment that the viewers pass through that has a series of openings that show you views of this interior space. And there are different views of the same space that reveal different things. And it's all in the center of the space is all life, like objects from my life that have sort of accumulated. So just in the most direct descriptive sense, that's what the show is. But I also wanted to create the experience of or a sensation of sort of going deeper and deeper and deeper and sort of further and further and further as the viewers progress. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but then I guess also if we're doing this for posterity, the installation is now gone and there's no chance to, I don't know, I guess I'll just describe it. I mean, I wanted to create a sensation of going further back in time as you progress deeper into the installation. And so I had the objects that you encounter through these openings basically begin with my current sort of developed adult self, and then had them progress sort of older and older and older in basically back into childhood to the very beginning. I don't know if that was the experience you had, but that was what I tried to create.
In reflection,
like I'm giving too much away. You know what I mean? It feels uncomfortable to speak so directly about something that I just want people to go experience.
Well, we all understand that artists are not the best to explain what they made, right? That's my core understanding of art.
It's someone else's job.
Yes. It's better for the artist to maybe not even understand. And maybe artists don't always understand what they have made until upon reflection, 20 years later, they understand. Yeah. We should say that you had a similar, but not exact, but similar installation at Marginal Utility in 2014.
2015.
And that was an up and down and scaffolding, and there was a central still life, as you called it. And so I wonder, upon reflecting, how things changed to change the installation between 2015 and 2024. What's changed apart from time? Or can you even describe what's changed? Is that a fair question?
Some of the mechanical, also I should, just for people that haven't seen it, describe there are some mechanical elements of the show that are interactive, where there is a mirror, or two places where there's a mirror that will move to different positions and then pause at an angle and basically pick out and present to the viewer one of the objects in the space. So since the 2015 version, I've learned a bunch more about how to build things. So technically the show is a little bit different or better in that way, I would hope. There's 10 more years added on my life. So I'm 10 years older and 10 years sadder.
Oh, wiser.
Hopefully wiser. I don't know. I don't know if we get wiser. So it's different in that respect. So this space, well, also I should say, this is the first time I've ever had a budget in any project I've ever done.
Oh, well, that's interesting of itself.
Better late than never. I had more resources than just my own resourcefulness, which was good. So this was able to be more ambitious because, one, the scale of the space, and two, I had like some financial resources from the Andrade Fund.
Yes, that's great. Yes, we should mention the Andrade Fund.
Thank them for that opportunity. It's pretty great.
Speaking about some assistance, I know that there was a friend of yours from Texas. Richard explained to us, and Matt, that there was a friend of yours from Texas who's a construction person and actually helped you create the stairs, for example, and whatnot, so that it was construction solid and all this kind of stuff.
So that's my friend Phil Jackson.
Phil Jackson, the artist, right?
Yeah, he was a photographer, also a friend of mine through skateboarding. He went to University of the Arts for photography.
Lived I know in New Phil York. Jackson. And,
yeah, really, really excellent, excellent human being. He lives in Austin now and has actually become a very, very skilled builder. And people sort of think of me as a carpenter sometimes, but I'm actually really terrible at carpentry. Like, if it doesn't fit on my workbench, I kind of don't want to work on it. But Phil's really good at building larger scale things like that. And so when we got the go ahead for the project, I immediately asked Phil if he'd be willing to come spend some time in Philly and help me. So he came for 2 weeks, and we figured out the initial staircase and that first room, the initial room where the show begins. Because I knew I wanted, for the show, I wanted it to start sort of at the top and then kind of wind down, 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 down. So that means that, you know, the first thing was, how do we get the viewers up? And then in a way that takes up the smallest footprint possible in the gallery. And actually took us a whole day noodling around and measuring to figure out just the best place to build that first room and also how to get viewers up there. Because, you know, you look at the Spruance Gallery with nothing in it in its normal state and, you know, you see it as very empty, but it's actually really full of stuff. And there is a lighting grid there that's at 12 feet off the ground that you just sort of visually, out of habit, you just tune out the lighting grid. But it's actually a pretty dense structure that was almost always in the way of everything we were trying to do. So it still, even in the current installation, it does kind of blend in. But man, that thing was a pain. It was in the way all the time. And it took us a lot of work to figure a way to build a conventionally scaled staircase that would take people through the lighting grid in a way that wouldn't take up an enormous footprint in the space.
It talks to how much engineering went into this project. In addition to the materials that you've collected and arranged, there was huge engineering that you undertook to do this.
Yeah, I mean, we figured out the staircase. The mechanical stuff I sort of figured out as I went. My intention was to have all of the mechanical things working before, because technically the residency was June, July, and August. I intended to have all the mechanical stuff worked out and functioning in the spring before I started in the space, and I could just bring it in and put it wherever it ended up. But I sort of lost my day job last year at the Wanamaker Organ.
So, oh,
no. Yeah, I mean, I was there 17 years and 10 months, and they gave us 3 days notice and 2 weeks severance. So
what are they going to do? Who's going to take over the organ?
Oh, I mean, it's a long story, but there was a person, this is a change of subject, but there was a person on staff from Macy's who technically worked for the Parade Studio in New York. He got laid off in January. We got laid off in September of 23, I believe. And then Matt got laid off in January of 24. The guy that runs the nonprofit, who I won't speak too much of, but he's the guy that laid everybody off. He has sort of become the by default curator of the organ, and it's a bad idea, but that's another story. What I was saying is I intended to have all of my mechanical stuff worked out before I started working in the space, but life intervened and that didn't work out. It was, you speak of the engineering, like I had less time to figure that out than I would have liked, but I guess that's how it goes.
Necessity. Well, I should say, and Ryan probably too, we love the interactive things.
Yeah.
They were really, really well laid out and you had to discover them. It was not like, here's an arrow pointing to something or other you're supposed to touch. It was a little subtle, but Ryan got it immediately. So I followed in his path.
Yeah. One of the things that I really wanted to do with this opportunity is make a space in the show that was accessible. Like, this was really important to me because in 2015, it was not possible for me to do that. I was like, okay, I actually have resources and I have a grant and a space. And so I did end up making an area that the entire show is built on top of an additional area that is very uncomfortable if you're standing up because the ceiling is so low. But if you're sitting down in a wheelchair, it's a perfect height. That's my intention. But you talk about the interactive areas. I wanted to have a third sort of interactive mirror mechanism at that lower level that could be used to basically point the mirror anywhere in the space and let people explore that central space from in the accessibility area. And I just plain ran out of time. And that's my fault for not being able to plan effectively enough. But anyway, in the future, I guess I'll just keep going. But I don't know. That is one of the ways I didn't succeed in the show, but it was not nearly as developed as I intended.
Definitely was a unique space. We did explore that lower under the other section there. Yeah.
We stooped our way through. We didn't get in the wheelchair. There's a nice wheelchair right there that people can sit in if they want to go through it that way. I love that setup. It was beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I tried. I don't know. I mean, my intention was I wanted to have an area, like a part that would sort of come down from the ceiling there that would stop sort of almost like the height of a desk, right? Mm-hmm. So that you could, in the wheelchair, roll your legs sort of like underneath the desk and have a almost like a periscope coming down that you would look into, and then you'd be able to move like through like touch controls, similar to the second mirror in the show. You'd be able to direct a mirror and sort of explore the space visually from a position underneath. But I just couldn't get it done. I mean,
you did a lot. You needed a 6-month residency, not 3 months, you know?
Yeah. I think that would have been, put an end to my life. I don't want to sound like I'm complaining, but I mean, it was I've never worked so hard for such an extended period of time. I mean, I was there like 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, June, July, August, and half of September. And I mean, it was like, wake up, eat a sandwich, and then just go straight back to what I was working on, whether I was working on the mechanical stuff in the studio here or working on site there. But my approach was, if I'm going to drive all the way to Arcadia, I'm going to stay 12 hours. If I make myself go all the way there, I'm not leaving until I work for 12 hours and then clean up, you know?
Yeah, it felt like you built the house inside of a room.
Yeah, it was about that. No, it was about that scale. And it was about the same level of construction quality as half of these houses they're building in Philadelphia too, which is to say, built it with reckless haste. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like the life of an artist, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm lucky that I get to work on something I care about that much.
So talk about clock work and clock fixing and clock making and all that, because that's part of what you do.
Now it is. Well, I went to school for furniture making at University of the Arts, did that for a while and managed to slowly build up my own workspace. But I always wanted to learn machining and sort of like how to make mechanical things out of metal. And I just didn't know where to go to learn that. And then in 2017, I met a guy named David Lindo, who was a clockmaker, and he lived outside Scranton, Pennsylvania, and he just was an amazing and supportive mentor. And he said, "We have a guest room. Come to my shop. Bring something to work on." Like, and I was like, "Okay." I don't know. In 2017, I started spending weekends or a week here, a week there, living at my friend David's house in his guest room and just working in his shop every day. He has a shop space that's in the downstairs of his barn. I mean, it's a very rural, it's called Lake Ariel, PA. It's a very small rural town.
So how does he make a living from this? Or is this—
He doesn't know either. He's he was a manufacturer of clock movements, and he had raised four children while doing this. So I think things have changed a lot in the clock world. And he has since started a foundation called the Plumier Foundation, which is focused on ornamental turning lathes. And that is now, they're building a building outside of Pittsburgh. So when he started doing that, I think in 2019, it was just a little bit pre-COVID, he couldn't or didn't want to or have time to work on the clock movements anymore. And so he passed one of the clock movements in his business, he passed off to me. So he's sort of like my clockmaking mentor. I manufacture these things called banjo clocks, which is just a small time-only clock movement made of brass. The design is from 1802, and it's kind of unchanged since then. And I think I am the last like manufacturer of this particular type of clock movements in the US. Huh. So mostly they're purchased by woodworkers who want to make a clock, but which for them means the case. So some of the ones that make a clock case and they don't want to put a crappy battery powered quartz movement in it. You know, they want to put an actual like weight driven wind up clock movement.
Wow.
I've made maybe two dozen of them.
Really?
Yeah, which is not that many.
Seems like a lot to me. It's a rather niche market.
I get it. Well, it is small. I mean, you know about how to make a small fortune in clockmaking. You know about this?
No.
You can make a small fortune in clockmaking by starting with a large fortune and working full-time for 10 years.
Work it down.
Yeah. I'm working on that, except without the fortune part. Yeah, so that's clocks. But most people that describe themselves as a clockmaker really what they mean is they restore clock movements, which is a whole nother thing. And I don't do very much of that. I mean, I can a little bit. I have restored some clock movements. I've never had the experience of working in a clock shop where there was a constant stream of different types of movements coming through. So, I mean, I'm far from an expert, but there is one type of clock movement that I do know how to make and have made a lot of. So that's partly what I'm working on these days.
That's the banjo clock, right? The
banjo clock movements, yeah. Almost done with a website that people can go to purchase them.
All right, let's talk about, if you could, your connection to the Masonic. Is it a religion or practice?
It's certainly not a religion. Okay. The Masonic Temple. I mean, so the Masonic Temple in Philadelphia, in particular, is right across the street from City Hall. I think the building had its 150th anniversary last year. I mean, it's a fraternity. There's a lot to talk about, but it's an old organization. My maternal grandfather was a member of one of the lodges in that building there. I don't know. In terms of my personal connection to it, in 1996, I was a sophomore in college at University of the Arts, and I knew art students and I knew skateboarders, and that was it. I just moved back to Philadelphia, and I'd been reading about Freemasonry, and I saw that building there, and I thought, wow, this is crazy. Look at this crazy building. And so I just walked in the side door and went to the first person at a desk that I saw and said, I've been reading about this. It seems fascinating and I'd like to join. And then eventually, I mean, I sort of kept after them a little bit. And then, I don't know, 1997, I joined Harmony Lodge number 52, which is one of the Masonic lodges that meets in the building there. I don't know. That's my experience. I mean, what else would you like to know?
Well, how does it impact, is there an ethos that impacts your art making? In other words, it's an old organization. You call this a fraternity. Fraternity means there's community. So yes. I see a lot of community in what you do. You're revealing yourself. It's very vulnerable what you did. I want to say I think anytime an artist puts themselves out there, they're vulnerable to criticism or misunderstanding. And that takes a lot of guts to do that. So I really applaud that. But the fraternity aspect, the community aspect, the sort of tutorial mentorship, I mean, I see you as someone who has at your core an educator ethos, that you're talking to people in your art, not only explaining what you're doing and revealing yourself and aren't I great and this is my life, but it's like, think about this, and you're trying to imbue a certain thought process through your art for people to pick up and think about. So you don't necessarily want them to think only about you when they're going through your installation, right? It's not about that. No. So
okay, there's a lot there in what you just said. I'm not sure which of those threads to pick up.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but just pick one out and go for it.
But, well,
does it come from Masonry? Masonry has temples, right? Temples are sacred places.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Masonic, it's a little hard to describe, but so Freemasonry is kind of like an oral tradition that's very long, and it's the whole thing is sort of based on ritual, and ritual is kind of a weird word, and you can hear it the wrong way. It just means there's a predetermined way that you start the meeting, you read the notes of the minutes of the previous stated meeting, like. It's kind of like a preset way to do things that's kind of unchanged, and that's sort of the point of it. And that's one of the aspects that I like. But in terms of community, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot to what you just said, and I'm not sure where to go with it. But I don't know it, but in terms of the personal aspect of the work, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it is pretty vulnerable, but you know, there's always the question of like, who cares? why should anybody care? I don't know that they should from one point of view, but then from another point of view, I feel like as an artist, you have to depart from the position that it matters. As in like your starting point needs to be the idea that what you do matters. Like yeah. you just have to start there. And I mean, it has to matter to you anyway. In the end, I feel like nothing matters. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I don't know. Just make what you want to see and nobody can stop you. Just go do it. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't have a pre-planned speech, but
I appreciate all this rambling, and I'm sorry I led you.
Yeah, well, that's all I'm good for is rambling. I think people's experience matters, and
do you think your current show has a ritual, or were you trying to express a ritual? When I was experiencing it, it felt like there was some religious overtones in the with all the wood, and like the energy that I was getting was very much. Not like you were stepping into a temple or a synagogue or a church of some kind, but there was definitely some sort of connection to that experience. Huh.
Interesting. Well, I guess I should also say, like, I am not religious at all. Like, yeah. I am not religious at all, but I love churches. I mean, I worked on pipe organs for a long time. And like, I think... Oh, I don't know. But what was your question? Like, you're saying, does it seem religious? I mean, I like the undisturbed aspects that you often find in places like churches, where it's just, they made a beautiful and careful space, and then they just left it alone. They just left it alone and took care of it for 100 years. You know what I mean? I think that's an aspect that I like about like religious spaces. I think maybe like what you're talking about.
Okay.
Like undisturbed spaces. I like. And it's funny, but those, I think there's an aspect of undisturbed spaces that I feel like Joseph Cornell has in his work, if you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Like the spaces that are left undisturbed are often spaces that are unoccupied, if that makes any sense. Like attics and storerooms and interstitial sort of places that aren't occupied very often. And there's something that I like about that. The show is sort of like a big metaphor, a big giant walkthrough version of the unconscious. Do you know what I mean? I mean, quite intentionally. I mean, that first mirror that you encounter, I intended that room to have a door on it, so that you would have to actually open a door and go through that first doorway that's there. But it ended up not, like, literally not fitting. Hmm. And I didn't have time to solve the problem of making a sliding door or something. But I really wanted that first room to sort of be the starting place, and then feel like you descend from there, but that, like, you know, if you remember, there's the mirror and the sort of shelf, and basically that's just like, I mean, the title is Rumination Mirror, but that's like the bathroom mirror at 4 a.m. when you can't sleep. You know, it's just sort of, I just tried to build a literal version of just overthinking your life and things that have happened, you know, from that mirror. And then you can, if you want, just descend from there and just burrow as deep into it to the bottom if you want. It's really what I tried to create. Well, I don't know if this makes any sense.
Oh yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Or if it matches your experience of the work, I don't know.
Well, talk about the words, because rumination, you don't ruminate with someone else, you ruminate by yourself, right? Isn't that generally the connotation of the word? So
of course.
Yes, you're going to ruminate at this mirror and then look out beyond and keep ruminating. It's all about ruminating throughout the whole space. Except for if you go through it with a buddy and you're talking and you're not ruminating, I guess you're having a conversation.
Yeah.
Unless there's a rumination à deux, you know, you got two people ruminating at the same time. But, and you also use the word transitional somewhere in some of the write-up about this piece. There is transitional, always changing, perpetual motion, those sorts of ideas that add up to a life, actually. I mean, what is a life if not ever changing and transitional? We're always in a transitional space.
But where do I go? Well, so transitional, I mean, at the end, the last thing is my transitional object, which is actually like, I mean, if you look up the, like, it's a psychological term, but it's basically your transitional object is, it's like your, you know, your childhood teddy bear or your comfort blanket, like Linus's blanket, like your, it's like literally technically your first possession, like as a human. I mean, and you can look up the psychology of it, but it's like the, you know, it's like your comfort object. So that's where the word transitional is in there. And that's what my other, the 2015 show was named Transitional Objects. So that's where that word comes from. And you talk about, it's funny, you talk about community. And I was joking with someone about, I forget who it was, someone that came to visit when I was working on the, you know, building the show. And they were talking about art and community. And I was like, I want people to come to my show and feel alone. I want them to go in there and feel alone. There's no community. And
oh my God, you're so right. That's ridiculous.
I mean, you're alone. I mean, in the way that you're like alone inside your solitary self. You know, no one knows you the way you know your solitary self. Isn't it great when we can successfully invite someone else in? I don't know.
It is. It is great. I just want to ask, I think we should wrap it up. We could go on for another hour. I want to ask, what's your relationship to the digital world? You obviously have this robust relationship to the non-digital world, the world of material. So are you on the internet at all?
Yeah. I mean, I have like a completely normal Instagram life. Oh, I should say, weirdly, there isn't any easy place for people to go and look up my artwork on the internet. And I should probably change that. But my like day-to-day, I don't know, bread and butter, you know, income work, I put on Instagram. I've got a Facebook somewhere that I almost never look at, I think. But I do go on the internet. I don't spend a lot of time there.
Do you save things? I mean, people have various ways of dealing with the internet. You can copy a link. You could bookmark something. You could download something and then save it somewhere else. Do you do any of that sort of thing? It seems archiving, you know, in a way that there was archiving in your piece of materials?
Not so much on the internet, no. I mean, something I meant to mention before is like partly what the show is made of, it, for me, is like, and I'm not the only artist that's like this, but it's almost like my past is intrusive. Like I pick up anything that's in here, like whatever object, and all of a sudden, I just unintentionally remember where it came from, or who gave it to me, what was going on in my life when I got it. And I like all the sort of information that's attached to the thing just swims up to mind, whether I like it or not. And I think lots of people have that. But partly that's what the show was composed of. And the locations of the objects are sort of related to that, to answer your question from 20 minutes ago. Digitally archiving things, I don't. I probably should be better about that, but I don't really spend a lot of time online. I mean,
Leave yourself any notes from the previous show to this show, like leave yourself or make something specifically in this show as a note to yourself, from your past self or to your future self or something along those lines in this show?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, there's a cabinet in the show that has like sketchbooks going back to the beginning of back into the early 90s. And I take a ton of notes on these like note cards. I mean, I don't know. I just always have like kind of note cards on hand. I mean, like I said, in the inventory, like I consider list making as a constructive form of worry. So, I mean, I make a lot of lists. I don't know. I can be kind of scatterbrained for sure. So it does help me to write things down.
Did you leave yourself any Easter eggs that like only you specifically would enjoy seeing, knowing how much internal materials there were, like personal material?
Oh, in the show?
Yeah.
I mean, I think in a way the whole thing is like that. But I don't know. I mean, there are things for individual people that they would probably see and be able to pick out, like friends that I have or, you know, loved ones. But I don't know if I've left too much for myself in there.
So you left them notes?
In a way, yeah. There, I mean, there are things for people to see, I think, that people that know who they are. What was I going to say? So I know we're running out of time, and this is another topic, but I want to ask, what's going to happen? What are we going to do with art? I mean, the University of the Arts is gone. PAFA, kind of, sort of gone. I mean, hanging in there and certificate and stuff, but like, is there still going to be like fresh energy coming to Philadelphia? Like, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? This is really important to me. Mm-hmm. I know we don't have time to answer this question, but I mean, I want to ask you, like, what are you, like the two of you, what's your quick thought on this?
It's what up should... to you, Scott, to change the world.
I mean, I within arm's reach, I try, but.
That's all you can do. I think that's what's going to happen within arm's reach. We're all going to change the world and help each other. You know, we can't put the UArts back together. We can't put PAFA back together, but we can do something amongst ourselves that makes ourselves happier and nurturing to younger people coming up who want to be artists. There will always be artists. You know, people need, it's a human need to make art. And so we have to find a way to nurture the children and make art available to them so that they can produce in the future the art that we all are going to need to go forward.
Yeah.
That's a really bummer note to leave it on.
Let's talk about something that's good. Okay, so if people can, there's this artist named Paul Etienne Lincoln. Don't know if you know him. He's probably my favorite living artist and a very great friend. He finally has a decent website put together. So he's ahead of me in that respect. It doesn't work very well on phone, but if you have a normal bigger sized screen, like a laptop or desktop, go to pauletiennelincoln.com and look at his work. Love the guy. Shout out to Paul Lincoln. I don't know. There's also a large list of people who rose friends that rose to the occasion and really saved me with this show because I didn't get done on time. I missed the opening deadline, as you know, but it would have been much, much worse if not for all the people that are listed in the thank you in the inventory also. So nice. Thanks to the friends that are there, which I won't list.
That's great. This is a great little book, a great takeaway that you made for people to have your list. And I love the way you categorize your list as, what did you say? Something, it's a really good way to get rid of your worries. Something like that. That's a misquote, but we got.
I said list making is a constructive form of worry.
Yes, constructive form of worry. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, we could go on and on. Oh, I did want to ask you about Dot. How's Dot?
Oh, she's great. She's just over in the other room. My African gray parrot. She's wonderful.
How old is she now?
Great. She is 23.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have her as a wee one? Was she a little one when you got her?
When I got her, she was 3.5 months old. So she was just weaned. She was about the same size that she is now. But we are both a lot younger. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Does Dot say any words to you?
Oh, yeah. She says all kinds of things. I mean,
like what?
Well, she sort of generally says what she wants. Like she'll say, want to go back, which normally means she wants you to take her back to her cage or take her away from wherever she is. She asks for like grape or paper or she'll just say, want some, want some, want some. Like you can't chop vegetables in the kitchen without her starting up with the want some. She says, I love you. She says, I love you, bird. What else? I don't know. She's got all kinds of things that she says.
That's
whatever
great.
Kind of going on.
Does she see you as a bird? When she says, I love you, bird, is that you?
Oh, well, she's just sort of repeating, but yeah, I don't know. She probably thinks that she's a person and we're just really mean to her and keep her in a cave.
Yes, she's a person, definitely.
Yeah. She's pretty happy, I think. You know, I've got a spot in every space and bring her around in whatever room I'm working in, you know.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it's great. I recommend parrots as pets. I think they're great. I don't know. Yeah. It's a good city pet.
And they're happy. Happy is so important. That's what we all need. That's what's going to help us get through in the future. Happy.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of happy.
No, a good amount.
Okay, a good amount. All right, Scott.
Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you. Likewise. And we'll be in touch. Have a good rest of the day. Thank you.
Heard of Ryan. Great to see you. Thanks for your patience.
Thanks so much.
Great to see you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.